I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be joined today by Ari Berman, who has been working the voting right, voter suppression beat for years, and he's the author most recently of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Let me tell you first, though, after hosting and producing this show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews in 2014, and since then, I've dug in every week to the archives to stream one of the relevant earlier interviews each week on Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes or Podomatic or at my site, which is terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. And following the election of Donald Trump, however, I cannot resist exploring our path forward in confronting him and his administration, thus the recording you're hearing right now, which is being recorded on August 8th. And first off today, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward a healthy, progressive future we desperately need. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want to get these websites and more information. So here they are, indivisibleguide.com. It's probably the most organized national organization. Ourrevolution.com, which is the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, which of course has been around for years, but has realized that they need to sort of match their online activism with more closely with on-the-ground action. Fivecalls.org, which will, whenever you call, give you the calls that you might be recommended to make to affect policy. Townhallproject.com, which will tell you when your representatives are holding town halls in your area, and they are on a break right now, so you might get the opportunity to let your representatives hear from you during this period. And finally, CourageCampaign.org, which is primarily in the state of California, and like Move On, has grown to integrate more action on the ground, grassroots action, along with its online activism. Again, email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want more information on resistance to the Trump administration. Well, preparing for this show, I got angry. I've been reading, knowing about this stuff for years. I did a number of shows about voting issues after the 2000 election stolen by the Supreme Court. Following the 2004 election, I talked about our need for a restored democracy trifecta: campaign finance reform, media reform, and election reform. And by that I mean fair, transparent, and accurate elections. I've often made the point that the Republican Party and its beliefs and its policies, while passionately held by millions, are no longer those of the majority of Americans. So the only way they could survive, and in fact they're doing much more than surviving, they are dominating right now, is to game the system. Their voters are more likely to vote, especially in non-presidential elections, and they have strategically exploited that advantage to gerrymander electoral districts and pass laws to suppress voting, leaving us with Trump in the White House, GOP majorities in both houses of Congress and the Supreme Court, and a vast majority of state legislatures and governorships. Now, there's a disconnect between what this country wants and needs and what those now dominating the federal government want to do. I believe this is a dangerous breakdown in the system of governance of this very powerful nation. This country has enormous gifts, enormous power, and in a time when the issues of climate change, economic justice, terrorism, nuclear weapons challenge us globally, as a country, we're not answering the call. And I know all too well what a poor job the Democratic Party does representing the real needs of most Americans and representing the future, particularly in their inability to win elections. They are consistently outmaneuvered, outmessaged, and outfought. One example, which I believe had significant repercussions, this is just one. In 2009, Obama still had congressional majorities, yet in negotiations with the GOP, he cut $40 billion in aid to the states from the stimulus package. In return, he got not a single GOP vote in the House. Now, after that kind of a bad faith negotiation, I would have gone back the next day and had my majorities pass a bill for $40 billion or more in aid to the states. It would have been Obama's version of Reagan's FAA moment. It would have shown him to be tough, fighting for the states. The money would have been spent immediately, which would have helped the recovery. Some states might have been saved from near bankruptcy, California included. States would have been in debt to Washington and to Obama, and the Tea Party, which hadn't yet really emerged, would have had less fuel. But tonight, that's last night as I was preparing, reading this stuff, preparing questions, I got angry. Gerrymandering and voter suppression fail us all. We cannot let this stand. It makes cynics of millions that we need to be involved, leaving the voting booths once again to the minority who keep these cheaters in control. And I haven't even mentioned Trump's Election Integrity Commission. Ari Berman is senior reporter for Mother Jones magazine. And prior to joining Mother Jones, which was just recently, he was senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine, a fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written hundreds of articles for The Nation since 2003. His stories have also appeared in The New York Times, Rolling Stone, The Guardian. His first book was Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And his latest, as I said, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Welcome, Ari Berman, to Free Forum.
Hey, Terrence. Thank you for having me.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us briefly about your path to the work you do today? Feel free to go way back, mention mentors or turning points, moments of decision.
Sure. So I started covering politics for The Nation magazine after I graduated college in 2004. And I was in New York City with The Nation. I was blogging. I wrote this blog during the Bush administration called The Daily Outrage that was basically about one outrage a day that the Bush administration did. And it was honestly hard to narrow down just one. And then after a year at The Nation, I went down and I became one of our Washington reporters in our D.C. bureau alongside David Korn, who is now the Washington editor of Mother Jones, but at the time was the Washington editor of The Nation. And I was there for 2 years, and I covered Congress, and our office was a block from the Capitol, a block from the Supreme Court, and a block from the Senate. So it was really kind of in the epicenter of everything. And then kind of burnt out on D.C., came back to New York, covered the 2008 presidential campaign very closely, wrote my first book after the 2008 election called Herding Donkeys, which was about the history of the Democratic Party. And then I was just kind of trying to figure out what I was going to cover next. And I noticed after the 2010 election that a lot of states had passed new laws making it harder to vote. And I honestly didn't really know that much about this topic. But nonetheless, I pitched a story to Rolling Stone about it, and I always tell young journalists not to pitch things that they don't know that much about. Nonetheless, that's exactly what I did. I pitched this story to Rolling Stone where I had written one story before because I knew they had covered voting issues and I knew the editor there and I wanted to write a bigger piece for them. And surprisingly, they said yes. And so I did this kind of crash course in understanding voting in this country and the debates over voting rights. And this was back in 2011 when these kind of laws, whether it was voter ID laws or cutting early voting or closing polling places or purging the voting rolls, really had gotten very, very little attention. There was almost no attention about this in the New York Times, the Washington Post, other places back in early 2011. And so the story that I did for Rolling Stone, which came out in August of 2011 and was called The GOP War on Voting, was really the first major national magazine story to delve deeply into this topic following the 2010 and the 2008 election. And I thought I would write one piece about voting rights and go back to writing about just general politics for The Nation. But what happened was that, first off, the article got a lot more attention than I had anticipated. People obviously felt very passionate about this issue. And then, secondarily, there were then court battles, there were new laws passed, and I realized, like, this could be a full-time beat for me. And not only that, but even though I knew almost nothing about the article when I first pitched it, I quickly became one of the only people covering this topic, I soon realized. I realized that there were very few people that were paying a lot of attention to these kind of issues. And so really it just kind of became a full-time subject for me, covering voting rights for Rolling Stone, for The Nation, for the New York Times Magazine, where I've written, and now for Mother Jones, where I'm on staff.
Okay, it's funny. My next question was going to be, you wrote an article titled The GOP War on Voting way back in 2011, but obviously you just covered that. But what I was going to say was, you talked about a GOP war on voting, and that war is still raging, right? And thus you ended up sticking your neck out and ending up with a full-time gig.
Yeah, the war on voting was just starting when I started writing about it. I mean, obviously you can go back much longer in time, and we've kind of always had a war on voting in this country given our history. But what I said is, if you look at the data, following the 2010 election, that's when new efforts began to emerge to make it harder, particularly for Democratic-leaning constituencies, to be able to vote. And to me, this wasn't that hard to figure out, that in the 2008 election, what we quickly realized, there were 5 million new voters. And of those 5 million new voters in 2008, there were 2 million African-American voters, 2 million Latino voters, and 650,000 Asian-American voters. So virtually all of the new voters in 2008 were people of color. And they voted 75% for President Obama. And this was what political scientists called the coalition of the ascendant. This was supposed to be the new normal in American politics. And the fact that there were so many new voters, that they so heavily aligned with President Obama, that they were so overwhelmingly voters of color, really set off alarm bells within the GOP. And instead of deciding to reach out to all of these new constituencies, the Republican Party realized instead they could just try to make it harder for them to vote. They could mess with the election mechanics just enough to try to erase the demographic edge that the Democratic Party and President Obama were building. And so I think that that's really what begun in after the 2010 election, when Republicans controlled all these state houses for the first time, whether it was Ohio or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or North Carolina or Florida. And so they had the power to do this, and they also had an incentive to do it, to try to counter the Obama coalition. And that this effort is still very much going on and, in fact, intensifying today.
Right. I mean, as I said in my intro, it's the only way that they can possibly have the kind of dominance that they do at this point. Now, we're going to talk a lot about voter IDs and voter suppression, but many of those laws, as you just pointed out, are made possible by the gerrymandering that they did following the 2010. And you and I have talked about this before. Let me just say a case that I've made. I'm going to return to the first years of Obama's administration. I believe the place where he dropped the ball the worst, he and the Democratic Party, was failing to aim everything he did toward generating turnout in 2010 to pull that new coalition and get them excited about going to the polls. Legislative districts are redone every 10 years following the census. So half the time that election is a presidential year, which favors the Democrats, but half the time it's not, and 2010 was one of those. And we have the 2010 midterms to thank for a lot of the gerrymandering and a lot of the voter suppression. Correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Democrats picked a very, very bad election to lose in 2010. In some ways, it would almost have been better if they lost the White House in 2008 and gained the Congress and state legislatures in 2010.
I'd never thought of that, but you're right.
Than the reverse of what happened, because, you know, while President Obama was an eight-term president, Republicans controlled two-thirds of the states of the country for the majority of his presidency. And they had one-party rule in so many important swing states that they were able to get a tremendous amount done in Wisconsin and North Carolina and Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan and all of these really important swing states. And the first things they did were twofold. They passed new laws to make it harder to vote so that they would remain in power, and then they gerrymandered so effectively to make sure that their win in 2010 would extend for the next decade. And indeed, the new maps are going to take place, the new maps that will be drawn after the 2020 census, those elections are going to take place under the existing maps that Republicans gerrymandered. So if you look at the data, and there's a very good book about this by Dave Daly, the former editor of Salon, called Rat Fucked. That's kind of a companion to my book, Give Us the Ballot. And what Dave just told me when I saw him last week was that Democratic candidates would need to win 58% of the popular vote to be able to take back the House of Representatives. So that's just staggering to me. I mean, they can't win 51%, 52%. I don't know if that number is exactly right. Maybe it's 55%, maybe it's 56%. The point is, Democrats can't win 50% of an election and believe that they're going to win 50% of the seats.
Well, let me cut in for a second.
Much higher number.
Let me cut in for a second, Ari. I'm not that surprised because they won well over 50% in 2016, and they did not, and they still are completely swamped in the Congress.
Totally, but I think most people are under the perception that if you win a majority of votes, you will get a majority of seats. And unfortunately, that is not how it works in most states in this country because of gerrymandering.
Exactly. And I'm saying in terms of Congress, the Democrats outpolled the Republicans by, I think, something like a million votes. And yet, what, are 35, something like that, behind in the House?
Yeah, I think the numbers I saw was that in 2012, they got 1.2 million more votes and Republicans gained 30-something more seats. I don't remember. In 2016, I think Republicans actually may have gotten more votes.
Oh, okay. So
I have to look back at the data, but certainly it was true in 2012 that you had a massive disparity between the popular vote. So basically, I mean, what we saw with Hillary Clinton winning 3 million more votes and losing the Electoral College, we're seeing that play out on a constant basis when it comes to elections for the House of Representatives and also elections for state legislative seats in places like Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Michigan.
Yeah. Let me just give you one more thought about that Obama era as we look back at, you know, at I say the sort of the balls dropped and so on. I recently interviewed Naomi Klein, and in her book, No Is Not Enough, she made a point that I hadn't really considered before. A huge political and cultural opportunity, like Obama's first term, where you've got a new candidate, new voters, you've got both houses of Congress, that doesn't come around often. In that way, it almost has to be, and this I thought was interesting, it almost has to be treated like a crisis. That is to say, urgency, focus, commitment, accountability, a moment of opportunity. A moment of opportunity like that is more valuable than years of business as usual. And to waste that is itself a crisis. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, so it's interesting. I mean, I personally think that President Obama got a lot done in the face of unprecedented opposition. But it's true that not everything they wanted to get done got done. And they also messed up a lot of the politics of what they did get done. You know, I was listening to Al Franken's book recently on tape. It's very long, but quite entertaining.
And I would imagine,
tape.
I would imagine, by the way, that's the way to listen to it. Yeah.
I think the way to read it is to listen to it because he reads it. So, I mean, you're hearing it all in his voice, which is great.
Yeah.
But he reminded me that, you know, he wasn't seated until June of 2009. Because of an extended recount in Minnesota. So the Democrats didn't have 60 votes in the Senate for a crucial period of time when they could have passed stuff in the Senate. Secondarily, they then lost 60 votes in the Senate when Scott Brown defeated Martha Coakley. So we can argue about whether or not you should need 60 votes in the Senate to pass something. Republicans were just about to pass repealing Obamacare by 51 votes, and they couldn't even do that. But the point is that according to the way the game was played, Democrats didn't have 60 votes in the Senate for even a lot of Obama's first 2 years in office. If you look at what the House of Representatives passed under Nancy Pelosi, it was unbelievable. They passed so much stuff, whether it was on climate change, on immigration, the Employee Free Choice Act, and people forget about all of the stuff they passed. The problem was the Senate. The problem was the 60-vote impediment in the Senate. And then the problem was then they lost their majorities in 2010, and Obama couldn't do anything for 6 years because of Republican obstruction. So I think it's a complicated argument that I think you have to make in terms of what he did or didn't get done back then.
Yeah, no, I mean, looking at how difficult it is in this broken system, this, you know, sort of this new brand of politics, which is all opposition all the time. I do look back and say, you know, yes, he accomplished a great deal. I do think that the administration, his people and so on, didn't realize how rare that was. It's like when you talk to a young ball player who goes to the you know, the Super Bowl or the World Series his first season and thinks it's going to happen every year, and you don't realize, you know, how hard that is. But I saw Al Franken speak recently, and he pointed out very quickly that point you just made, and I do forget that, and I think many of us do, that actually it was not a filibuster-proof majority for the first 6 months of that term, which is a lot of your momentum time.
Exactly, which was their crucial momentum time when the House was passing all of this stuff, and then it was just dying in the Senate. And, I mean, I think the Obama administration made a lot of mistakes in its early days. And I think appointing Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff was a terrible mistake, a guy who embodied business as usual when the president was supposed to be a change-type figure. I think relying on Max Baucus to craft the health care bill bipartisan support when there no bipartisan support was ever going to be forthcoming. I mean, I'm not saying they didn't make a lot of mistakes. I think putting Tim Geithner in there as Treasury Secretary and being so close to Wall Street was both substantively bad and also killed him on the politics of it in the 2010 election. So I think they made a lot of mistakes. I'm just saying that I think the structural impediments were greater than a lot of people recognize.
Okay. We've got about 40 minutes left, and we're going to, as I said, we're going to definitely talk about voting rights and voter expansion and voter repression and so on. But what I, because we have, you know, a fair amount of time here, what I'd love you to do is give us some of the history of those issues, not just how did we get here today, though I want that, but maybe even a little broader. I recall during the Bush v. Gore conversation, one of the right-wing judges, I think it was Scalia, saying that the right to vote was not guaranteed by the Constitution. What did the founders think of voting? Yeah. I assume we've gone through cycles where the view of voting and who gets to vote has changed. What's that story?
There's a fundamental contradiction in American history, which is that we are supposed to be the country that said all men are created equal. The shining city on the hill, as Ronald Reagan said, that's exported democracy all across the world. But in fact, even our founders didn't want everybody to vote, and very, very explicitly said that the right to vote was going to be limited to only certain people. So, for example, at the beginning of our country's history, only white male property owners could vote. And that's the way it was for a long time. And then there was a very, very slow expansion of the franchise, you know, to non-property owners, to people of color, African-American men for a time. But that was taken away to women, but that took a long time. And so if you look at this country's history, we never have had a constitutional right to vote that has said everyone should be able to vote except for X, Y, and Z. We've had a lot of prohibitions on who can and can't vote. And even the progress that has been made has often been marked by very, very sharp retreat. So what I find so interesting in American history is that, you know, we fight a civil war to end slavery. We pass three amendments to the Constitution, the 13th, the 14th, the 15th Amendment, that are supposed to guarantee equal rights to African Americans, at least to African American men. And we pass the 15th Amendment that says very explicitly the right to vote shall not be abridged or denied on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. For a brief period of time, that means something during Reconstruction. African-American men get the right to vote. There's a tremendous surge in black voter registration and African-American voting. You have black governors and senators in places like Mississippi and Louisiana, something that's never occurred since. But then federal troops leave the South after the disputed election of 1876. We begin to see things like poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses. We get Jim Crow, and that situation basically exists until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And that's where my book begins, because I think the Voting Rights Act is the first piece of legislation that really made America a functioning democracy for the first time. With all its flaws, this was the first piece of legislation that said definitively everybody has the right to vote, regardless of race, or regardless of class, or regardless of all of those other things. And so I think it was a tremendously important piece of legislation. The problem is that ever since the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, there has been a very determined effort to try to roll back that law and to limit its achievements. And, of course, we're seeing all of that today.
Is there, you mentioned following the 2010 election, and specifically the 2010 election in the states and so on, but is there a moment, when I look at a lot of the right-wing activity, you can go back to the Powell memo in the early 70s as laying out an agenda. Is there a moment, a meeting, a Koch brothers confab or something that sort of said, okay, this is the new agenda, cross-check, et cetera, we're going from here?
You know, I have never found a single piece of evidence that says, like, we're going to make it harder to vote and this is how we do it. I think what we began to see was that in the Bush administration, following the 2000 election, we began to see the beginnings of efforts to make it harder to vote. We began to see the first voter ID laws. We began to see prosecutions for voter fraud that were totally bogus. We began to see major investigations. This whole idea of voter fraud that was a totally manufactured crisis really started beginning in the Bush era, but then it dramatically intensified in the Obama era, and you had organizations like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that were writing photo ID laws for the state, so you began to see identical pieces of legislation be introduced over and over and over. I think basically when that started happening, I think states started learning from each other, and they realized that if one state can get away with it, another state can get away with it, and then they began to attack the Voting Rights Act itself. And that was a long movement, but it really gained steam after the 2010 election as well. And when they were able to gut the Voting Rights Act, that meant that those states with the longest histories of discrimination could approve their voting changes with the federal government, no longer needed to approve their voting changes with the federal government. So previously under the Voting Rights Act, if North Carolina or Texas or Georgia, one of those states with a long history of discrimination, wanted to implement a new voter suppression measure, they had to get it okayed by the Justice Department and the courts. And sometimes in a conservative era, they were able to do this, but a lot of things were blocked. A lot of things they've tried to do were they were not able to do because of the Voting Rights Act. When that protection was removed, the floodgates began to open. And so we had a situation where voter suppression efforts were intensifying in the South because they were no longer subject to federal approval of their voting changes, but also these same kind of efforts were being exported to the North because suddenly politicians in Kansas and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, they were interested in doing the same kind of stuff that had been for years associated with places like Alabama or Mississippi. And it was a more sophisticated thing. It wasn't let's prevent everyone from voting, or let's prevent an entire race or class from voting. It was, let's see if we can shave 5% off the margin here, 2% off the margin here, 3% off the margin here, and that'll help us win in a close election, and we'll be able to get it through the courts as well.
Yeah, and the majority in the Supreme Court justified their decision to weaken the Voting Rights Act by claiming there was no longer cause for the extra protection of voting rights in those jurisdictions. And are there specific data that indicate a difference that the Voting Rights Act in its full form might have made in 2016?
Well, so it's interesting. I mean, basically what the Supreme Court said was that the very success of the Voting Rights Act was a reason for its demise, that because the Voting Rights Act had been so successful in increasing black voter registration and black turnout in Georgia and Mississippi and all of these other states, therefore it was no longer needed. At least parts of it were no longer needed, which I think a lot of people felt was a very curious argument. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, that's like throwing away your umbrella because you're not getting wet on a certain day. It's still going to rain. Yeah, and we saw that. We saw that immediately after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, Texas implemented a strict voter ID law that had been blocked under the Voting Rights Act. North Carolina passed the country's harshest voter suppression law. And some of this stuff was subsequently blocked by the courts, but other stuff wasn't blocked. So to give you one piece of data, there was a report that came out before the elections that there were nearly 900 fewer polling places in southern states because the Voting Rights Act had been gutted, and states no longer had to get approval for closing polling places, which is a small thing, but something that can make a big difference.
Well, and let me just go, I mean, I got this from your writing, but nearly half of the counties that previously had to have their voting changes approved with the federal government, nearly half of those counties cut polling places in 2016.
Yeah, so I mean that was a pretty dramatic example of what the loss of the Voting Rights Act meant. There were other things like, so North Carolina was an interesting place because North Carolina, a month after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, they didn't just require voter ID, but they cut early voting, they eliminated same-day voter registration, they eliminated out-of-precinct voting, a whole list of things. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that this law targeted black voters, in the court's words, with almost surgical precision, which was a really remarkable argument to read, to hear them call out the state in such blunt language. And what happened was early voting hours were restored because North Carolina had cut early voting from 17 days to 10 days, and early voting hours were restored. However, local counties had the option of setting those hours, and Republicans had a majority because they held the governorship on every single local board of elections in North Carolina, and there's 99 counties in North Carolina. They also had a majority on the state board of election in North Carolina. So this Supreme Court decision comes down to restore voting rights. The first thing that the Republican Party of North Carolina tells all of these county election board members is you should use whatever leverage you have to limit early voting, that you should limit the number of locations, you should limit the number of hours, you should limit, don't put polling places on college campuses, don't put polling places in majority African-American neighborhoods. This is something that the courts did not get into. They wanted to give counties the flexibility to set their own hours. However, Republicans immediately exploited these kind of things. So what that meant in Greensboro, for example, there were 16 early voting locations during the first week of early voting in 2012. There was only one location during the first week of early voting in 2016. And voter turnout went down substantially because of this, particularly black voter turnout, because African-American voters were more likely to vote early. And then the North Carolina Republican Party actually put out a memo the day before the election that bragged that, in their words, Caucasian early voting turnout was up and black voter turnout was down. I mean, it was the kind of thing that was straight out of the Jim Crow South in terms of how they were talking about these issues. But that was an example of if all of these things had to be approved under the federal government, then even if the courts had restored something, if counties wanted to then further cut early voting, they would have had to get it approved by the feds. They didn't. So even with a good court decision, they were still able to cut early voting in a way that really hampered a black turnout there.
Very good. This is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Ari Berman. His latest book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And as he's laid out here, he kind of stumbled into this beat and has been at it now for 6-7 years. And you can learn more at Ari, A-R-I, hyphen Berman, B-E-R-M-A-N, Ari-Berman.com. Let's talk a bit about the role of voter ID laws. In 2016, 14 states had new voting restrictions in effect. Not all voter ID laws, but new voting restrictions. And you have talked about a study by Priorities USA, which you point out is a Democratic Party-affiliated group. It's not been peer-reviewed and so on. But some of the findings there, especially what happened in Wisconsin, could you share a bit of that with us?
Yeah, so this was a report that got a lot of attention, not all of it good. A lot of it directed at me, even though, as you mentioned, I did not write the study. I just wrote about it.
And you clearly said in your article the limitations.
I am not. I don't do data mining. I am not Cambridge Analytics. Okay, I'm just a journalist. I just write about stuff that people give me and that I observe, and I try to do it as accurately as possible. This study by Priorities USA looked at states that had adopted voter ID laws in 2016, and they compared turnout in those states to states that did not adopt strict voter ID laws in 2016. What they found is that turnout went up in states that didn't have strict voter ID laws. It went up by something like 1.7%. On the flip side, states that did adopt voter ID laws, turnout went down by 1.something%. And the biggest drop in turnout was in Wisconsin, where there was a 3.3% drop in voter turnout overall. And Wisconsin, which is usually basically the number one or the number two state in voter turnout, fell significantly. And what Priorities USA said was that there are a whole number of reasons why turnout could have went down. But they said that if Wisconsin had the same increase as every other state, meaning if the voter ID law had not been in effect and if turnout had increased in Wisconsin like everywhere else, then 200,000 more people would have been able to vote. Basically saying that there would have been 200,000 more voters if not for the voter ID law in Wisconsin. So that's the way the study played out. I don't think we're ever going to be able to know how many people were prevented from voting. We're never going to find everyone who went to the polls and was turned away.
Yeah.
We're never going to find the number of people that didn't show up at all because they thought they didn't have the right ID, the number of people that weren't even registered to vote. But I think the question to me isn't whether or not the voter ID law cost Hillary Clinton the election. I think that's the wrong question to ask and an unknowable question. I think the question is, were people prevented from voting, and were they prevented from voting for no good reason? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. There were definitely hundreds, if not thousands, of people prevented from voting, and there was no good reason to do it.
Right. And as I want to point out that this group, Priorities USA, estimates that 200,000 more might have voted in Wisconsin. Donald Trump won the state by only 22,000. I think it's worth
yeah.
pointing that out.
And what I realized looking back on Wisconsin history was that the earlier elections were even closer in Wisconsin, that the 2000 and 2004 elections were decided by about 5,000 votes.
Mm.
So this, we could be facing razor-thin margins in a place like Wisconsin that are much closer, in fact, than even Donald Trump's margin in 2018, in 2020, depending on how everything shakes out. And so I do think that these laws can make a big difference in a close election. However, I think we should be analyzing them regardless of whether they impact an election. The fact that one party, to me, has deliberately made it harder to vote and has disenfranchised people and has disenfranchised them for no good reason, to me, is a huge scandal.
Right. And even though we've pointed out that the founders weren't big fans of everyone voting, it does feel un-American, if you will, that there is a party that is actually one of their primary strategies for electoral politics is to make it harder and harder for people to vote. And I do want to point out, according to a 2006 survey by the Brennan Center for Justice, 7% of Americans do not have ready access to citizenship documents, to the sorts of things that would allow them to produce those voter IDs. And so now,
yeah.
But let's shift to their justification for all of this, which is voter fraud. Voter fraud is so rare. Can you talk just a bit about how rare it actually is?
Well, I mean, it was always a very, very meager justification. And it was a justification that once these states actually were brought to court and had to present the evidence, you realize that there was just no evidence there. There was no there. And so the kind of fraud they said occurred most often was, and that voter ID laws could stop, because voter ID laws are only looking at one kind of fraud, which was in-person voter impersonation. So
right.
Someone going to the polls and saying they're Ari Berman and voting multiple times in my name. And I mean, that is a really incredibly stupid way to try to steal, an incredibly stupid and incredibly inefficient way to try to steal an election. I mean, you'd be taking an extreme risk
It's a felony.
And you'd be shifting one extra vote.
Yeah, it's a felony for one vote.
You'd be facing a felony. You'd be facing prison time. In some states, you'd never get your right to vote back. And you would be just achieving one extra vote. And you would have to know let's say you impersonated me in New York City where I live, and there's no strict voter ID law, so I just have to give my name, my address, and I have to sign my signature, and my signature has to match the signature on the voter registration books. Well, you'd still have to know where I live, mm-hmm. what my polling place is. You'd have to know that I hadn't voted already. You have to know that the people at the polling place don't know me,
right.
Which they do. And even if you did all of that, you would only be getting one extra vote. And it's mind-bogglingly stupid that someone would do this multiple times. Maybe every once in a while someone does it once. There was a case in Iowa where a Trump voter believed that the election was going to be rigged.
Right.
And because of what Donald Trump was saying, so she voted twice because she thought her first vote wouldn't count. Well, it turned out that she may have had some mental issues. This was not a widespread problem.
Right. And let me just read a couple of figures here that I also got from your work. The Washington Post found only 4 documented cases of voter fraud in 2016 out of 135 million votes cast. There were just 31 credible cases of voter impersonation from 2000 to 2014 out of a billion votes cast. 31 out of a billion.
Yeah.
And yet that is justification for, let's move now to the President Trump's Election Integrity Commission. First of all, where does that stand right now? A lot of states. Let me tell people about some of the players. Let's talk about Kris Kobach. Kris Kobach was the Secretary of State in Kansas, and he in 2014 became the only Secretary of State in the country with the power to prosecute voter fraud cases, which was his big claim, and he's convicted 9 people out of 1.8 million registered voters in Kansas. Who is Kris Kobach?
So Kris Kobach is the Secretary of State of Kansas. Most secretaries of state are very anonymous, kind of bureaucratic election officials. He has a very outsized role in the Republican Party and in the Trump orbit because he's really the leading figure for restrictions not only on voting but also on immigration. So he worked in the Bush Justice Department, and then afterwards he went all around the country writing laws to restrict immigration, including most famously Arizona's SB 1070, which was the Show Me Your Papers law, where the police could stop anyone they believed that there was a reasonable suspicion of being in the country illegally, which led to widespread racial profiling. So Kobach wrote all these anti-immigration laws. Then he became Secretary of State in Kansas and put in place all of these voter suppression laws. He didn't just do voter ID. He did something that I think is even worse, which is documentary proof of citizenship for voter registration, which means if you want to register to vote in Kansas, you have to have your birth certificate, your passport, or your naturalization papers on you. Well, most people don't walk around with those kind of documents. First off, a lot of people don't even have those documents.
Well, that was that thing I read before, the study at the Brennan Center, that 7% of people just don't have access to it.
I think the number is much, much higher than
uh-huh.
that. Only 7% of Americans have a passport, period.
Oh, my God.
How many Americans know where their birth certificate is when they go to register to vote? How many people know where their naturalization papers are? This is something that is incredibly rare. So what happened was when Kris Kobach put in place this requirement in Kansas, 1 in 7 new registrants were blocked from being able to register to vote, which is just an enormous number of people. Imagine there's 7 people in line to buy groceries, and 1 in 7 of them can't buy groceries.
Yeah.
And this happens all the time, every single day. That's what it was like to register to vote in Kansas before the court started striking down this law. And so basically he has been the leading architect of voter suppression efforts, and then Donald Trump tapped him to be the vice chair and the functional head of this quote-unquote Election Integrity Commission, which was premised on the gigantic lie that Donald Trump won the popular vote, Kris Kobach being one of the only people that defends this absurd claim. And then the first thing this commission did was they requested voter data from all 50 states. And they said they wanted publicly available data, but then Kobach asked for all of these things like social security numbers, criminal history, party affiliation, military history, that was not at all public. And that sparked a widespread outcry among states. They've now sent a second letter. Some states are going to give them limited data, but Kobach's not going to get all the data he wanted, that's for sure.
Yeah, it seems like a weird kind of overreach. It seems like they were asking for data they didn't even need, and yet it helped strike up this resistance to it. And how many states have refused at this point? I know it was high at one point. I think some of them have compromised since.
Well, so there's different ways to look at the data. The latest data that we have is that 21 states said they're not going to give any data to the administration, whereas other states are going to give some publicly available data. So they're not going to give Social Security numbers or stuff like that, but they may, like New York said, that they're going to give some limited public data. I don't think this is going to be nearly enough for the Trump administration to try to do the kind of analysis that they claim they want to do. I think this entire thing is rigged to begin with, so I think it's kind of pointless. They're not going to undertake any real study. This is not people that are going to undertake a real study. These are a bunch of propagandists that were put on this commission. But nonetheless, I mean, even for their stated purpose, they're not going to have the data they need to do any kind of accurate study. So we already know from the very beginning that whatever findings they put out are going to be flawed from the very outset.
Well, and help me with this one. If everyone kind of knows, that's actually telling the truth and looking at the data, that fraud is minute potatoes, not even small potatoes. How does, and I've heard both sides believe, that this will lead to greater voter suppression, that people will be more likely to be willing to pass voter suppression laws because of this commission. But if the commission actually does research and finds what we already know, why would that lead to the bad outcome?
Well, that's a good question. First off, I think a lot of people do believe there's widespread voter fraud because Donald Trump and Chris Kobach and so many Republicans keep saying that. So I think if you look at the data, a lot of Republicans do believe there's significant voter fraud.
Okay.
So already they've been successful in getting a lot of people to think that. Secondarily, the lack of data is not going to stop them from analyzing whatever data is available and putting out a whole lot of misleading statistics. So Chris Kobach's done this in Kansas, where he has access to the cross-check database that searches for double voting. And the cross-check database searches for double voting among 32 states are part of it. And it uses very, very basic data, only first names, last names, and date of birth. And so what happens is, people will be confused with another person because there's what's known as a false positive. And in fact, there was just a study that came out that said that Mike Pence, named Mike Pence,
yep,
with the same birth date, voted in six different elections in 2016. So obviously the vice president didn't vote six times. He was confused with somebody else, according to CrossCheck. And so the thing here is that, it spits out all of these false positives, and you hear all of these people are registered in two states, all of these people have voted twice. When you drill down the data using more sophisticated data, you realize that there are very, very few double voters in America. And so that's the kind of thing I'm worried the Trump administration is going to do on a nationwide scale. And not only that, but we already see the Department of Justice is sending states letters telling them they're preparing to sue them, to force them to purge the voting rolls. We're going to have all of these Republican secretaries of state that could do different things. We already have Republican control of state legislatures across the country. They could potentially be influenced to do more things. So I think just because this data request got off to a bad start, I don't think that we should be naive to believe that this administration or this commission is just going to close up shop and be totally ineffective. Their work may be completely discredited, but that doesn't mean they're not going to have an impact.
Well, and so I'm not sure you quite answered my question, and I think the answer probably is reality is irrelevant here. But the more research they have, the more data they have, the more it will show that there is no fraud. You're saying that won't matter, that the mere attention to it is the point, and the other half is that the data they've gathered is going to help them do a better job of suppression?
My point is that they are going to identify lots of false positives of fraud. And they're going to make it seem that fraud is far more common than it is, because they're going to use databases that are not designed for these purposes, that are very inaccurate, that are going to have, you know, lots of double voters, they're going to claim lots of non-citizens are voting. I've already seen Kobach do this kind of thing in Kansas, so I know how it's going to work. And basically, he's going to churn out all of these incredibly misleading statistics. And they're going to claim they found a smoking gun. It's going to be total BS, but at least a certain segment of the population is going to believe it, because they either just have a pre-existing bias, or they believe that there should be some weight given to a presidential commission and to secretaries of state and all of that stuff. And so that's my concern here, is that Kobach's just going to have a platform to basically produce a whole lot of BS. And a good portion of the Republican Party is going to embrace it. And some Republicans will think it's BS and will embrace it anyway, just because it helps them make it harder to vote. And that's what their real agenda is, that they know voter fraud is BS, but they have to come up with some reason, some excuse, some rationale for voter suppression, and this is what they've got.
Okay, let's talk just a little bit more about cross-check. You said it's in 32 states. That's because those states have kind of signed on and said, we want to do these kind of purges? It's kind of out there and available in those 32 states?
They've signed up to say they want to do the analysis. They haven't necessarily signed up and said, we're going to take your data and then immediately purge the voting rolls with it. I think a lot of states are not doing that, in fact, because that's illegal under the National Voter Registration Act and other laws, to just take cross-checks data and remove people from the rolls. But I think that there are certainly states that are comparing data, and there is probably a smaller number of states that are using it to purge the voting rolls.
Okay. And by the way, I would refer people to Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T, who has done an enormous amount of work on looking at cross-check and investigating the results of cross-check. Let's talk about one thing we haven't talked about, which is the fact that there was recently a hacking competition, and they were able to hack very quickly, I think, into just about every state's voting systems, electronic and online electronic voting systems. Why haven't we done something about that? And you know, I'm going to quote you: Russian hackers targeted election systems in 21 states in 2016. I mean, according to intelligence officials, targeted election systems. The House Appropriations Committee voted to defund the Election Assistance Commission, the only federal agency that helps states make sure their voting machines aren't hacked. The $4 million funding request is less than the cost of two trips by Donald Trump to Mar-a-Lago. What gives? Are they that confident that the hackable systems will always favor them?
It's really crazy. I mean, honestly, this is the thing that keeps me up at night.
Me
because
too.
The suppression by the GOP is terrible, but we see it happening.
Right.
We see the laws passed. We see how it's going. This is totally in the dark. If someone hacks our registration system and someone hacks our voting machines, there's no way I'm going to know about it unless it somehow gets out. And so we already know our voter registration systems are compromised. They were compromised in 2016. Most people believe that the Russians were just doing a fishing expedition or anyone else for that matter, to gain greater expertise for a much bigger hack in 2020. And if you were just to, you know, take down voter registration lists, delete names, change addresses, change names, that alone could just create an absolute amount of chaos in an election. But the voting machines themselves are more vulnerable than people think. A lot of them are extremely old. I couldn't believe this when I was doing research for my Last Nation article, but about 42 states have voting machines that's running software that's over 10 years old. I mean, how many people still use a computer that's 10 years old, let alone voting on something that's that old? I mean, they're running Windows 2000. They're running Windows XP. These things are so old, you can't even get the kind of security updates to try to protect it against hacking. There are states like Georgia where there's been close elections that have no paper backups. There are 14 states in whole or in part that have no paper backups. So if you hacked a voting machine, people wouldn't even know about it. I think it's basically, number one, the Republican Party believes that the hacking benefited them, so they don't want to do anything about it. The states are broke. They don't have any money to fix these voting machines. Congress doesn't want to do anything. And so we're basically either stuck in willful ignorance or inertia, and there's this enormous election crisis that's right around the corner, and no one's doing anything about it. This, to me, would be the first thing you'd study if you had a real election integrity commission. There is no bigger threat to election integrity than the fact that our voting systems themselves could be compromised.
Yeah, and for anyone who's new to this issue, the point that Ari made about not being paper verified, unless if you go vote on a computer machine and you don't get a piece of paper that says how your vote was registered, anything can happen, as we all know. 14 states now don't. Do you have any idea what percentage of the population those 14 states represent?
So I forget off the top of my head. I do know that that includes cities like Atlanta, Philadelphia, Dallas, Houston. So some of the biggest cities in the country are voting on machines with no paper backups. And I just find it so astonishing that we spend billions of dollars on our elections, but we can't spend a few hundred million dollars to get some new voting machines that everyone can trust. I mean, you think this would be something that, at the very least, there could be bipartisan agreement on this?
Yes, you would. I mean, I'm remembering Y2K, which, you know, turned out not to happen. But there was,
yeah,
you know, there were a lot of people spending a lot of attention and a lot of money on this. And this one is right in front of our noses.
And I have to say, you know, I have been someone that has been skeptical of a lot of the claims about electronic voting machines being hacked and this kind of thing. There is an element of the left that I think has been kind of paranoid about this stuff. But I have changed my own feelings about this because of what we saw during the 2016 election. The fact that we know now that voter registration lists were hacked, we know that emails were hacked, we know that they're going to try to do it again. There's no denying that it's occurring, and there's no denying that it's going to happen on a broader scale at some point, whether it's Russia or Iran or North Korea. I mean, just look at what happened with all of the hacks from Game of Thrones recently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're so vulnerable here, and it's just crazy to me that this has not gotten more attention, given the revelations that we've seen already in 2016.
Yeah, and I don't have the information in front of me, but there was, you're aware of it, right? Within the last 2 weeks, there was some sort of a hackathon where some of the best hackers got together, and they were like into state systems in half a minute, in a minute. I mean, I now believe there's no matter what I do in 2018 or 2020, I have no reason to believe that the election results are going to be accurate.
Well, and I mean, I think when you talk to experts, they say this is not rocket science here, that just backing up everything on paper would be a very good first start. It wouldn't eliminate all of the problems, but it's a very simple step to be able to take. Get newer voting machines, or just vote on paper alone, that have verifiable backups. Do regular assessments. Basically, treat voting like you would any other security issue.
Sure. Yeah.
And we could do it. So it's not a question of whether we could do it. It's just a question of, you know, who's going to step up with the political will. We can't rely on the Trump administration to secure voting systems. And I don't think we can rely on all the states that are currently suppressing the vote to try to fix this either.
Okay. We're going to have to close it at there. So again, the website is Ari Berman. That's Ari-Berman, B-E-R-M-A-N, ariberman.com. The book, his most recent book, is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, which also does have the history of voting rights in America. Thank you, Ari Berman, and keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot, Terrence. I appreciate it.
Okay. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. And thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.